We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. After World War II, the United States launched a major effort to rebuild Western Europe. It was formerly known as the European Recovery Program, but informally, it's known as the Marshall Plan, named for the U.S. Secretary of State at the time, George Marshall. The government, over 4 years, invested something like $13.5 billion in Europe, and those are 1940s dollars. That would be more like $100 billion today. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about an aspect of the Marshall Plan that I expect a lot of people will be unfamiliar with. As part of the plan, close to 300 films were made, and these were films that were made by Europeans for European audiences, designed to promote the benefits of democracy and the free market. Most of these films have never been seen in the United States because of a U.S. law that made it illegal to show them. But now, people around the country are getting the opportunity to see some of them, and people in and around Champaign-Urbana will have such an opportunity next week on the U of I campus, as the European Union Center of the U of I presents Selling Democracy, the Films of the Marshall Plan. And our guest this morning, Sandra Schulberg, will be here to show some of these movies and also to talk about them. She's the director of the Selling Democracy Project, and she's been researching the Marshall Plan's use of film since 2003. She's been doing some interviews with all of the surviving filmmakers. She's founder and former president of the Independent Feature Project. She is co-founder of First Run Pictures. She's been an advocate of independent film now for more than 25 years. She is an award-winning movie producer in her own right, has done a lot of work in public television. She's going to be visiting the campus of the university next week, and this would be the 24th, 25th, and 26th to talk about some of these movies and to show some of them, and they will be shown at the Krannert Art Museum. And it's free and open to the public. Anybody who would like to attend should feel welcome. We'll talk a little bit more about that a little bit later. Questions, though, certainly here on the show are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if people want to join the conversation, they can do that. We just ask, please, people be brief in their comments, as brief as can be, so we can keep moving along and do stay on topic. But, of course, other than that, folks who are listening are certainly welcome to call. Again, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Ms. Schulberg, hello.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me to speak to your audience.
Well, thanks very much for joining us. I think this is a fascinating subject, and certainly I was not aware that these films existed, and I suppose there are a lot of people who weren't, perhaps because they're not steeped in the history of the Marshall Plan, but also because, as I mentioned, and we can talk about, They were banned from being shown in the United States.
They've been a very, very well-kept secret, I discovered when I first saw them myself. And partly it's that the post-war is decades behind us, but as you say, it is also because they were legally banned in the United States until an amendment to the Senate Foreign Relations Act was passed in 1980, introduced by Senator John Kerry, which made it legal to show these films for the first time.
And just to be clear, the reason that they couldn't be shown was that there was this law that applied to things like the Voice of America and other efforts at what I suppose some people would say were propaganda directed at the outside of the United States. There was this law that said those things, tax-funded things, they can't be aimed at U.S. taxpayers. They have to go aim out. They can't aim the other way around. So that was why, until this change came about, you couldn't have seen them in the United States.
Well, that's right. The Smith-Mundt Act of 1948 was intended to make sure that that information programs that were designed by the U.S. government for foreign audiences would not blow back into the United States. It wasn't directed solely or specifically against the Marshall Plan information program. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to note also that the 1990 amendment was not, although it was motivated specifically to make the Marshall Plan films viewable, it applies to all information produced for international audiences. Now, after 12 years, it is legal to show the work in the United States. Mm-hmm. But what I find an interesting anomaly in this is that that law, Smith-Mundt, was passed to make sure that work produced by American governments not be shown to American audiences. So it is this notion that we should protect Americans, quote unquote, from our own propaganda efforts. Mm-hmm. But what is a sort of an anomaly here, interesting point, is that these films not produced by the Americans. They were produced, they were made by the Europeans or European audiences. But they got caught up in the Smith-Mundt Act because they were made under the general auspices of this international program, the now known as the Marshall Plan.
Yeah. Your connection to this in part is personal because your father was involved in the Marshall Plan film program.
Well, he actually made what we now consider to be the very first Marshall Plan film, which was a fascinating and quite witty film called Me and Mr. Marshall, which we are going to show, in on the campus at the Cranard Art Museum next week. That was made in Berlin about the impact of the Marshall Plan on Germany and on the rest of Europe. And as a result of that film, he was recruited to serve as chief deputy and then chief of the entire Marshall Plan motion picture section based in Paris. He was one of the very few Americans who was involved in the Marshall Plan film program because, say, the vast majority of the films were made by European filmmakers. And they were really reporting their own experience. They were right there on the ground. The films were not being made, 3,000 miles away in the United States. They were being made by people who were living through the same post-war agonies and rationing that everyone else was going through.
And one of the things that I've read is that before the Marshall Plan film started to be made, that the U.S. Army actually made a movie intended for German audiences. And just from what little I've read about it, it sounds as if the thrust of the movie was to tell Germans that, in fact, if they were living under bad circumstances now and the country had been reduced to rubble, that basically it was the fault of the Nazi government. And apparently people in Germany reacted very badly to that.
Yes, you're probably referring to a film called Hunger that my father made he was, at the same time that he made Me and Mr. Marshall, somewhat earlier, a few months earlier, while he was serving as chief of the documentary film unit for military government, that it was that unit's job to, quote, denazify and re-educate the German public. And my father and his colleagues really wrestled with the very difficult question of how you address a hostile audience. Hunger was a film that, as I say, he made earlier in 1948. Europe was still, had been through a terrible winter of 47, and Germans were hungry, in a sense, for the first time, because they had fairly well fed during the war, but it was really after the war that they began to suffer. And this film, Hunger, pointed out that they were not the only ones hungry, that there were people all over Europe hungry, with pretty gruesome images of people in Naples and Paris and and Athens scraping garbage cans to eat, and basically blaming the Germans for this widespread hunger. Well, that didn't go over very well. The audiences booed the film. When they saw Göring on the screen, they, according to letters my mother and father wrote at the time, they said Hellman wouldn't have let us starve and so on. And the military brass sort of panicked and pulled the film from the theaters after about 3 weeks. They learned, Stuart Schulberg, my father, and his colleagues learned quite a lot from this. From then on, and you can see this so clearly in me and Mr. Marshall, they took quite a different tack and began to try to embrace the average German citizen in the making of the films. In Me and Mr. Marshall, for instance, my father uses a young Wehrmacht veteran, a young German army veteran, he as the central character, and we hear him say, you know, it kind of reminded me volunteering to go to work in the Ruhr in a steel mine, in a coal mine. It kind of reminded me of being in the army. And that's just one of the tropes that's used throughout the film to help the audience make a connection with this young veteran who's now kind of joining the European recovery program and turning from a kind of bitter Nazi draftee into a Marshall Plan aspirant. So the film ends with him saying, you know, name Hans Fischer. I'm working in the mines all day, 6 days a week. Just call me a Marshall Planner. Hmm. And the change is just a completely different tone from Hunger, which has much more of a hectoring quality, you know, sort of shaking the finger at. So I think this is one of the things that makes the Marshall Plan film so watchable today, is that they seem to be very funny. They certainly are message films. Few of them are what I would call, you know, hardcore propaganda films. I think it's more interesting. They're far more subtle than that, and it's more interesting to look at them as agents of social change, as films that are attempting psychological persuasion, but persuasion, say, rather than propaganda, and that are really instruments of, today we would probably call public diplomacy, a term that didn't exist at the time. It was invented in 1965. So they're very, very varied in their style. The filmmakers realized that if they didn't make them entertaining, the audience would just, you know, come late to the cinema. The films were shown as shorts, generally in front of the longer feature films once the theaters reopened. And so they had to function as entertainment. They were also quite dependent on the commercial distributors to show them in the cinemas. And the distributors also didn't want to turn off the audience. So along with the newsreels, these Marshall Plan shorts tended to be funny, short, and also some of them quite moving.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're talking with Sandra Schulberg. She is someone who has had a lot of experience as an independent film producer. She is also adjunct assistant professor in the film division of Columbia University's Graduate School of the Arts, where she teaches film financing. She will be here on the campus of the University of Illinois to show and talk about some of the films of the Marshall Plan. This is a project she's been involved with for, I think, now a couple of years, traveling around the country, giving presentations. She has been working on talking with some of the people who made these movies, and I think eventually the idea is that some of this will be available on DVD so that people can see it at home if they don't have the opportunity to attend one of the screenings, like the one that you're doing next week.
Well, I hope so. I've been working for several years on raising the money to do a proper DVD collection of 50 to 100 films. It's been very difficult, and I haven't gotten there yet, but we're getting closer. The you mentioned my interviews with the surviving filmmakers. I'm trying to get to all of the surviving filmmakers, a number of whom have died since I started this project in 2003, unfortunately. One just died, another just died last month. It's really a race against time. There are so few people alive who were part of this program that I feel an urgent need to get to them. Also, very few witnesses are still alive. When I show the films in Europe or the United States, fortunately, there's almost always someone who comes forward in his or her 80s who comes with an eyewitness report of having seen a film. Or when I showed the films in London in December of last year, I'm sorry, in November of this year. No, for heaven's sakes, forgive me. We showed them in June of this year in London. One of the people in the audience turned out to be a Marshall Plant cameraman, someone I'd never heard, whom my father had hired. And he gave me extraordinary information about how the films were cataloged and sent out, and he later became he started as a messenger in the film department, and then he became an assistant cameraman and then a very well-known cameraman in his own right. So I'm very dependent on people coming forward. Most of these films did not carry any credits at all, as is characteristic of government films, whether produced abroad or in the United States. So it's been very, very difficult to, you know, even to learn who worked on these films.
And I think also it's my understanding, you tell me if this is right, that there is no complete catalog of these films. No, you don't know. Apparently no one knows even exactly how many there were.
Well, we do have, thanks to an extraordinary researcher, Linda Christensen, we now have as complete a catalog or filmography online as it's possible to have, considering there's still a lot of unknown information. Mm-hmm. Anyone interested in consulting that list can go to marshallfilms.org, which is a website under the aegis of the George C. Marshall Foundation, which helped to fund her work. And without Linda's work, it would have been impossible for me to do mine. So what I've done is now delved deeply into the history of the Marshall Plan Motion Picture Section to try to get documents that have not been available about how the films were made, contracts, scripts, talking to the people who actually worked on making these films. But it is true that there are some titles that we know of that where we have not located any film print. So we know that of a title that exists, but we don't have the print. There are others where we have many where we have knowledge of the film, but no knowledge of who actually made the film. There's no one archive. These films that are on Linda's filmography are scattered in archives around the U.S. and Europe. There's no one place you can go to see all of the Marshall Plan films. This is another difficulty, terrible obstacle for those who want to study the corpus of Marshall Plan films. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, there are films that are held by an archive, but they're not viewable because they have only one copy. This has been a problem, for instance, in Turkey, where, in part thanks to my efforts, young scholars want to study the films, but the archive has only a few film copies, and they won't let them be shown because they haven't had the money to make protection copies, preservation copies, as we would call them. So there are many, many obstacles to scholars who want to study the films. In the United States, the largest collection is held at our National Archives, the Film Archive, which is located in College Park, Maryland. There are approximately, I believe, 187 different Marshall Plan films there. The list that Linda created is much longer than 187, because many films were made in multiple languages. So if you look at that list, you may get the impression that there are over 800 films, but actually it's a listing of what we believe is, at the moment, is 283 films that we know of, listed in many different language versions. And then of that list, there are about 187 discrete titles that are physically located at the Washington, at the National Archive in Washington in College mm-hmm. Park, Maryland. So it's complex. It's complex and confusing for people trying to access this material.
Well, one here, I want to make sure that for the benefit of people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, they know that you will be here on the campus next week. And as I mentioned, your visit here is sponsored by the University of Illinois European Union Center, with co-sponsor from a number of other departments. There'll be three sessions at the Krannert Art Museum of some of the films, and our guest this morning, Sandra Schulberg, will be talking after a couple of them on Thursday and Friday. So this is next week, September 24th and 25th, from 5:15 in the afternoon until 7:30. There are two programs of shorts, and then there'll be one more on Saturday from 2 to 4 in the afternoon. And I think that these are all free and open to the public. Anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome to stop by. And the questions here are welcome, too. Our guest, Sandra Schulberg, she's director of the Selling Democracy Project. She's been researching the Marshall Plan's use of film since 2003, has been working on trying to talk to anybody she can that was involved with putting these together. And she has traveled around this country and, in fact, in Europe, showing some of these movies. And as we explained at the beginning of the program, up until 1990, it would have been against the law to show them in the United States. So certainly very few Americans have had the opportunity to see them. These were films that were made as part of the Marshall Plan, films made by European filmmakers for European audiences. They were shorts, some with live actors, some of them were animated, and they were designed to be shown as a short feature before the main feature. And if you're interested, again, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, you'd like to see some of these things, you can do that here on the campus next week. Questions on this program certainly are welcome to 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. And we do have a couple of callers here. We'll start out with someone in Robinson, and this is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning, David.
Yes.
I have something that may contribute and associate the University of Illinois with this guest project. In the late 1940s, when I was a student there, the German department put on, or had filmed on a stage, I believe, in Lincoln Hall, an a cappella sung version of an old German Minnesinger classic, and the story was at the time that the government wanted to show this in Germany, to show the German people that we were not no longer angry with them and that we respected German culture. A friend of mine, Carl Carrier, sang the male lead of Joseph and Mary, and I still remember the refrain, Mary singing, "Oh, Joseph, liebst du, Joseph mine," and he responding, was ist, oh, liebe Frau mine.
Interesting, yes.
This may or may not have been tied in with the Marshall Plan, but it was a curious fact to me. Thank you.
All right. Well,
thank you for contributing that. I'm glad you raised the Illinois connection. I've chosen, and maybe I'll take this opportunity to talk a little bit about the films that I've chosen specifically for the program in Illinois at the university. Right as you alluded, David, with this film Hunger, there was a tremendous problem with food productivity after the Marshall Plan period, and so many of the Marshall Plan films dealt with food productivity, And there were technical assistance exchanges between European farm producers and American farmers. We also sent to Europe, you know, a lot of people profound misconception about Marshall Aid. They think it was money that we sent to Europe. It wasn't that Europeans needed. They needed food and they needed hard goods to restart industry. So we sent a tremendous amount, not just of food, but we also sent livestock. Two of the films that I'm showing next week in the first program deal with the fact that we sent livestock over. One of them is a charming, charming film, Hansel and the 200,000 Chicks, Hansel und die 200,000 Küken, which is about the fact that we sent live baby chicks to Austria to distributed to mainly young people who were taught sort of poultry raising methods and really ended up making an important contribution to the food shortage in Austria. So that's just a charming film. Then the next film that I'm going to show on the same theme is called The Story of... We sent live mules to Greece, to small villages where their own donkeys had been killed during the Civil War, during the war, first of all, and then during the Civil War that followed. So they had very few farm animals with which to plow and were doing... soil cultivation by hand. This is another absolutely enchanting story about a young boy who is the only one in the village to be able to tame these gigantic and quite obstreperous American mules, which came from states throughout the Midwest and the South. So I think that'll be a really fun film for local area to see. We're also showing one of the few films directed by an American. Wesley had won an Oscar for a film called Cimarron, and which was a Western. And when he went to Europe to advise on some of the Marshall Plan films, he ended up making the equivalent of a French Western set in the Camargue, which is an area of the south of France which is famous for its French cowboys because they raise cattle there. But they also raised a certain amount of rice. And after the war, there was a big effort made to encourage these cattle farmers, some of whom were quite reluctant, to turn over some of their land for rice farming. So this film is called Rice and Books. And it's a sort of a mini... drama, quite a fun, directed by the American Wesley Ruggles. We're also going to show one of the most moving films the Marshall Plan filmmakers made. It's set in Ireland, called The Barty O'Brien. And I think this film also will have a special resonance for people in the Illinois agricultural community because it's about rural electrification. It's about the struggle to bring electricity to these small, very out-of-the-way farms in Ireland, which was a very agricultural country and had been also was struggling to kind of come into a more modern era and improve and modernize its own farming methods. Promise of Barty O'Brien is a unique film for a number of reasons. One, because it deals with that topic. Two, because it was one of the few films that was a longer film. This is a film that runs almost an hour. And it was scripted and performed by a famous troupe of Irish actors, the Abbey Players, in Dublin. It's also typical, those are the things that make it unique. It is typical in one respect, and that is that many of the Marshall Plan films, and they are some of the most entertaining, were directed at young people or were about young people. So Hansel, The Story of Kula, and The Promise of Barty O'Brien all feature very young people in the lead roles. the Marshall Plan filmmakers somewhat skeptical that the generation that had fought the war would be able to, you know, overcome their bitterness towards the Italians and the Germans, or simply to depart from their very traditional ways of doing things, whether it was farming or producing industrial products. But they had a lot of faith in the young people, and so a lot of the films were aimed at young people for that reason. So those are the films that we'll see in the first program. May I go on and talk a little bit about the second program?
Well, I tell you what, I have a caller who's on hold.
Oh,
so why don't we talk with them, and then then we could go on and you could talk a little bit more about some of the other films.
Sure.
Here we have someone in Effingham on our line number one. Hello.
Yes, really short, and your guess is almost covered what my question was about, the purpose of the films. And I think I'll go ahead and listen, but that was basically what I wanted to ask, the purpose and the purpose and the motives of those who made and distributed them. Thank you.
And, you know, I guess I'm interested in, and you can respond to the question of the caller, but also as one dimension of this, we talked about the fact that you and I talked about the fact that most of the movies were made by European filmmakers. So one of the questions that I had was, well, you know, to what extent did the United States try to shape the content of the films? Did they say, we would like you to make a film about this or that, or these are the kinds of ideas or values we'd like to see you get into these films?
Well, both the caller's question and yours are excellent questions. Let me first answer his question about why they were made, and then we'll get into the policy control issues. The films were made for a variety of reasons. For one thing, people have to remember that this was in the age before television. I mean, television had been invented, but people didn't. There might be a television in the bar, the restaurant, one place in town, for instance, but people didn't have televisions and they didn't get their news from television. They got their news either from the newspapers or from the newsreels in the cinemas. So cinema was essential, really, to be able to show Europeans actually what was happening throughout Europe as a function of this enormous European recovery program. So people needed to see films to understand what was going on in their own country, because they might not know that, 20 miles away there was an ERP effort to rebuild a bombed out mine, or to build a new dam, or to introduce a new soil reclamation technique. But they also needed to understand that this effort was not just a national one, but that it was happening throughout these ultimately 18 different countries. So many of the films did double duty by being shown in a single country. So the story of Kula, for instance, would show Greek citizens what was going on in some of these out-of-the-way villages that were receiving mules. But then the story of Kula, which became one of the most popular Marshall Plan films, done in about 9 different language versions, would be shown throughout Europe to show the Irish and the Danish and the Italians what was going on with the Marshall Plan program in Greece, and vice versa. So the first purpose of the films was really information dissemination. The second element it was really psychological, and that is that people had very little hope, especially after this very difficult winter of 1947. There were food shortages, there were housing shortages, there were electricity shortages, and people were feeling pretty bedraggled. So one of the purposes of the Marshall Plan films was really to show people that there was this huge international effort going on to help rebuild all of Europe and to give European citizens hope that they could rebuild, that they could come out of the war perhaps stronger than before. So the film served as messengers of hope and and to exhort people, really, to believe in the future, to inspire them. So that was number two, this sort of psychological component. Number three, I would say that the film dealt with creating a new political vision for Europe, and that is the notion of a unique Europe. So there are a whole, if we can speak of these films as following different veins, you have the information film for dealing really with recovery and productivity. You have the psychological films, but then you have dealing with this idea of Europe. And I think many scholars today and historians credit the Marshall Plan for laying the ground for European Union. They did that by posing the notion of United Europe. They did that very specifically by making films that addressed head-on the issue of tariffs and trade barriers and frontiers. Many of the films deal with just this notion of what is us apart, all these frontiers. And the frontiers have a linguistic component, they have an economic component, they have a cultural component. In the second program, we're going to be a number of films that deal with this question of how do we unite to build a better future. A film called The Shoemaker and the Hatter, which is a delightful animated film dealing with the importance of dropping the trade barriers so that you can create a European common market. Showing a film called, a very funny, charming film called Let's Be Childish, which again shows how children are able to get together at this sort of winter resort in the Alps and overcome the language barriers while their parents are fighting with each other. So this notion that we can retain our individual and national cultural identities and our national languages at the same time that we can start to think of ourselves as Europeans. So that was number three in terms of the purpose of the film. And finally, I would say that there's a small vein of films that deal the issues of political ideology. And here you have the films that are what I would call somewhat more propagandistic in content and in style. Films that were, especially after the invasion of Korea, that dealt with the perceived threat of communism, that dealt with the idea of the importance of freedom and democracy. And in the third program, I'm going to be showing some of those films, a very funny anti-communist satire. And satire is pretty rare in the whole field of filmmaking in general, and certainly amongst the corpus of Marshall Plan films. But this is a film called Do Not Disturb, which is a satire on an anti-capitalist East German propaganda film, but sort of twists all the tropes around and turns it into a pro-Western, pro-democracy film. We're also showing another very witty film called Whitsun Holiday, which contrasts how people in the East and people in the West are spending their Whitsun Holiday, with Westerners being free and kind of chaotically so to go and do whatever they want by train, by bicycle, by car, where in the East they're all marching sort of with giant banners and flags in a show of solidarity with the communist party. We're also showing a fascinating animated film called Without Fear, which contrasts the democracy and fascism, which really stands as a kind of stirring tribute to the virtues of democracy and freedom, and as a warning of all forms of totalitarianism. It would have been read at the time as an anti-communist film, because the word communist is never mentioned once in the film. It ends up being kind of for all time, just about the danger of all forms of totalitarianism. Marshall Plan filmmakers did deal with questions of political ideology in some of the most interesting films. As for policy control, David, your question, I've interviewed, as I say, nearly all of the surviving Marshall Plan filmmakers, and to a man, and they were all men, they spoke with a kind of wonderment about the fact that there was no policy control. Also, Al Hemsing, who was the last acting chief of the Marshall Plan motion picture section, wrote about this, saying that he had worked at the Office of War Information during the war, where there was a great deal of policy control. But when he worked for the Marshall Plan film program after the war, there was basically no policy control to speak of. The ideas for the films tended to come from both the Paris headquarters, who had a kind of overview, and from people in the field in each of these countries at the various ERP missions, who would say, you know, we're building a new dam, and do you think we could make a film? Would you support our making a film about the building of this new dam, a very famous dam in Austria, for instance? Or, you know, all these mules are arriving from American farms and farmers, and some of them are too big to manage these tiny paths, and that this is creating turmoil and a certain amount of humor, and this seems like a great topic for a Marshall Plan. So it came from both the film ideas came from both the field, people in the field, and from the Paris headquarters.
We have maybe about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Sandra Schulberg. She's director of the Selling Democracy Project, and she has now for a number of years been researching the use by the Marshall Plan of cinema. And as we have discussed, there were several hundred films that were made, funded by the Marshall Plan, made by European filmmakers for showing to European audiences. And a lot of them, none of them really have been shown in the United States, or at least until 1990. They couldn't be shown in the United States. She's been working on this project, trying to document them, talking to as many of the people as she could who were involved with making them. And hopefully she's also trying to raise some money to have a DVD collection of some of these put together so that they can be seen in the United States. But she also has traveled around this country and actually around the world talking about the films of the Marshall Plan and also showing some of them. And she will be on the campus the end of next week, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Her visit sponsored by the University of Illinois European Union Center. And there'll be three sessions on Thursday and Friday, beginning at 5:15, and then Saturday at 2 in the afternoon. These are going to be shown at the Krannert Art Museum, where she'll be showing some of these movies and talking about them. So anybody who is in and around Champaign-Urbana should feel welcome to stop by and see some of them. Also here on the program, questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have another caller here in Champaign County where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm reminded by the work of the Congress for Cultural Freedom in the post-war era by Francis Stoner Saunders, which documents I don't know how to call it, a propaganda campaign that was mainly funded by the CIA, and a lot of intellectuals in Europe were really aghast when they found out that what they were doing. And I think there's a whole line about the Marshall Plan. I mean, you mentioned earlier the presumption is that it was a financial transfer of money, but it was actually aid in the form of very concrete, you know, things that were somewhat in oversupply here in the U.S., something that sort of captures it for me, and more generally about the Marshall Plan period, is that the amount of aid that equivalent that went to France was the amount of money that was spent on their continuing their cultural colonial attempt in Indochina and Vietnam, and that at the behest somewhat of the U.S. So it. The extent to which the Marshall Plan was Pax Americanus, I mean, of course, there were a lot of idealistic people throughout. I don't know how you would comment on that, particularly on the German, the program made for Germany itself. I'm wondering whether you can comment on who made those. Were they recent emigres to the U.S. that were mainly, or were there were actually people in Germany that may, or whether or was that a larger part of the of this role, or was this was that more directly under the the military aegis at the time? I guess I'll hang up and listen since there's a little time.
All right.
Well, you raised so many fascinating questions. Let me address the Congress for Cultural Freedom first and the revelation in 1967 that part of their activities had been funded by the CIA. In my view, some of the best investment the CIA ever made, as opposed to money invested in, you know, military uprisings and deposing governments that may have been freely elected at different times. The Congress for Cultural Freedom, and there's actually a fascinating Marshall Plan film called Speak Up, which documents the, in a sense, the creation of the conference that led to the Congress for Cultural Freedom. The Congress for Cultural Freedom, which began in 1949, was an attempt to take back, in a sense, while the East Germans and the Soviets were going to be the party of the true party of democratic freedom and liberation. There were a number of intellectuals who had been leaning, who began to be following the Berlin blockade and one's suppression of so many artists and writers, as other politicians in the Soviet Union, who began to be very skeptical, whatever their idealistic about the communist ethos might have been, who began to be very skeptical about how the Soviets were living out, let's say, their communist dreams, in fact, in the Soviet Union and in East Germany, and the rest of the became the Soviet bloc. So a number of intellectuals who had been left-leaning became anti-Soviet. They became what were called the non-communist left, the NCL. And the Congress for Cultural Freedom really represented their attempt to articulate this sort of, you know, intelligentsia's left-wing non-communist position, and also to provide very concrete support to writers and artists who were being suppressed in the Soviet bloc, to help get their work smuggled out and published in the West. That some of that effort, it later turned out, was being supported by the CIA, and that's, call it, a good investment, because I believe that those writers were, you know, deserved to be published, and if they couldn't be published in their home countries, they were right to help get them published outside of the Soviet bloc. It is true, and Mel Lasky, who's featured in Speak Up, and Kessler, and many, many great American and European intellectuals and writers were part of this whole effort, some of whom were not aware that the CIA was contributing to this effort. I do want to stress that the CIA's funding was only one part of the they raised to support all these efforts in support of writers and artists who were being censored. But it is true that because it was covert, this proved a source of embarrassment for a number of writers and intellectuals in the 60s who had supported this whole effort for, you know, for over 20 years. In contrast, the Marshall Plan films were always overt. There has been some suggestion on the part of some scholars, some Marshall funds were diverted secretly into this effort. I've read that material, and the documentation is not completely, it's not completely clear because these OPS monies were very tightly and secretly controlled. So it's not clear whether any of it was indeed Marshall Plan funds. That is an allegation.
Forgive me for jumping in on there you there, Ms. Schubert. I simply have to do that because we're here at the end of our time, and we're going to have to stop.
Okay.
I just want to make sure that one more time for people who are here where we are in Champaign-Urbana, that they know that you will be here at the end of next week, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, in a visit sponsored by the U of I European Center, and giving some presentations at the Krannert Art Museum, Thursday, Friday, 5:15 to 7:30, and Saturday from 2 to 4 in the afternoon. And we'll be talking about some of the films of the Marshall Plan and also showing some of them so people will have the opportunity to see them. And I just wanted to say to you, thanks very much for spending some time with us this morning to talk about the films of the Marshall Plan project.
Thank you, and I'll be answering many more questions, including who were the German filmmakers who were certified to make films after the war, as well as part of the Marshall Plan effort.
And thank you. Our guest this morning, Sandra Schulberg, she's director of the Selling Democracy Project. She is also adjunct assistant professor in the film division of Columbia University's Graduate School of the Arts.